Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by Anna Williams, Head of News for BBC World News. Anna drives the daily editorial agenda and long-term strategy across the World News division for a weekly audience of just under 100 million. She began her career with CNN Moscow, covering the Soviet coup in 1991, the breakup of the Soviet Union, and the ensuing economic and political turmoil. Anna moved to London in 1997 to be CNN's Europe producer, and then joined the BBC in 2006 as editor for World News. In addition to her current editorial role, she's also heavily involved in developing talent and driving cultural change within the BBC. Anna, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
So, Anna, Head of News for BBC World News, that's quite a mouthful. What does the job involve? What's a typical week?
So, a typical week is looking after the daily editorial agenda and just decide, you know, working out what the news is, what we're covering, how we're covering it. And then it's also thinking ahead, whether it's weekly, monthly or yearly, and basically thinking about what the strategy is, what we want to do, where the channel should be developing, what its audience is, who we're trying to reach. Just a bit of different everything. And there's a bit of HR and there's a bit of finance and there's a bit of management and there's a bit of everything else thrown into the mix.
Wow, so quite a lot of responsibilities then. What's your favourite part?
The editorial. Absolutely the editorial.
No one wants to do HR, do they?
You know, it's challenging. And obviously you want to consider the staff, you want to care for the staff, you want to help people develop, you want to nurture them, you want people to be happy at work. But you can't, they're not your children, you can't figure everything out for them. And at a certain point, people are grown-ups and have to figure their own things out. But and being a mother of two, I don't really want to come to work and be a mother to everybody else. But so the favourite part is always the editorial. It's what makes, you know, what I like is what makes things tick, why the world works the way it does, what are the common threads, the differences, all those sorts of things.
I mean, because that's one of my questions, actually, editorially, is you oversee hubs from Washington to Delhi. How do you actually choose between competing, you know, story pitches that are, in terms of the prominence and when they get on air?
We basically put the audience first and you work out who's watching at what time of day. So there is things like the complexities of the EU story, be it Brexit or be it, you know, EU internal integration or disintegration. If you think about the audience in America and the audience in Asia, then you know they're not really going to be into the intricacies of that in the same way audiences in Europe are. So, you know, you think about, well, actually, it's 2 a.m. in the morning. So who's watching? It's evening America, it's morning Asia. So you work your agenda, you know, you think about your story placement based on that. So the same way it is, if you think it's sort of 2 p.m. in the afternoon in London, we know that that's 9, 10 p.m. in Asia, in sort of Asia Pacific, and who's watching, you know, and it's Asia who's watching. We're not being watched, you know, that's not peak viewing time in Europe. So again, you think about what sort of stories you're doing.
So you must get a sheer sense of scale of that global audience. I mean, you said 99 million. I changed it to just under 100 ever the PR guy. But that's a seriously large audience, to state the absolute obvious.
It's great. And it's great that it's growing and it continues to grow. And it's a privilege to be doing that. But equally, I think we're probably unique in that it's also really hard because we're not the audience that's watching the channel, because you actually can't. So most of our staff can't actually watch the channel from here. They're not seeing it. They're not sitting at home viewing it and consuming it in this country. So also it's really hard because, you know, you're sometimes it's challenging because you're broadcasting externally out into the ether and you don't have that same immediate feedback that you might if you were working on some of the domestic programs here, where you know somebody is immediately saying, I like this, I don't like that, or we watched this, or you get, you know, your daily figures on the domestic bulletins, be it radio or TV, and you don't have that immediacy of knowledge. It has grown from strength to strength. It's just, you know, in fact, we just sort of jumped this year from 85 to 99, as you say, just shy of 100 million. But it's great to see.
It'll be 100 million by the time this comes out.
Yeah, exactly. It will do. And it's great to see that. And it's also great to see it continuing to grow in strength to strength, and for it to feel, you know, as a channel, more confident of itself all the time.
So you mentioned that 100 million people. Who are the audience? Where are they geographically located? What's their age range? And how are they watching BBC World News?
So there's a lot to unpack in that one. So first of all, if you think about geographically where they are, we know that we're very strong in North America because we get through essentially syndicated terrestrial distribution through our PBS affiliates, and KCET is one of the affiliates we use there. Equally, we have a cable distribution now that is growing in strength to strength, and that's been part of what's raising our figures, because it's always been hard to get on cable in the US. If we think about Europe, traditionally, again, very strong. We always know anecdotally sort of Netherlands, France, Germany, Poland, other areas of Eastern Europe. We've got good, strong audiences there. So part of what's grown the audiences recently are places like Indonesia, which are continuing to develop. And as we generally know, is that we tend to have very young audiences. So, you know, it could be average age. You know, we've seen sort of 25 to 40, 45. And the audiences are, they're young, they're affluent, they're aspirational. Much more, in slightly different to World Service Radio, where some of it is about sort of audiences in need, or it might be more, lesser developed countries. It's a bit of both. You know, with World Service, you have both the kind of North American audience, and you could have more of the African audience. So you can have a distinction between the two. And again, we know that we grow in Africa. Our audiences are growing all the time. Somewhere like Latin America, it's smaller, it's not as strong. So, it's a mixed bag, but generally sort of North America, Europe and Asia, both South and Asia and Southeast Asia. But China, obviously, we have a little bit of an issue about, free distribution there.
I can imagine. In fact, that actually segues neatly onto my next question, which is, what is the motivation for people watching and listening to BBC World News? Because in America, they have lots of other choices. It's almost like an ideal PR question, but why do they trust the BBC? Why do they want to watch the BBC over, say, CBS, NBC and ABC?
So I think if you think about BBC World News, we're not people's primary news vehicle, or we're not the primary place they go to get news, but we're the secondary, for example. So if you might, like anecdotally, we would sort of think if you were living in India and you might come home and you'd watch your local news at 6 p.m. and then you might watch a bunch of, do as you would do in this country, you might watch then you might watch some kind of soaps or dramas on TV, and then at 10 p.m. at night you might actually try to figure out, well, actually, what happened in the world today? Where does it all connect? So people come to BBC World News for that international news, for about what's happened in the rest of the world, how does that affect me, and why is that relevant to me, and what is, to that much larger global look. So you come to your own news provider in your own country for your local perspective, and then you come to BBC World News for the global perspective. And in places like, so when you think about places like Southeast Asia, everywhere is so interconnected, and actually what happens in America impacts them, what happens with China impacts them. So actually they need, whether it comes within our news or our business, that you want that step back look about thinking, well, actually, what was the impact on that? Whether it's today that, that there's going to be a Google antitrust ruling from the EU, and actually, that impacts on Europe, that impacts on North America. Actually, we don't look at it from the perspective of what does this mean for me here in the UK, or me here where Google is based in Ireland or something. Actually, we're trying to look at it from all sides. So that's the difference between us and CBS or NBC or anything else.
It sounds to me that even though the BBC is always impartial anyway, that you have to be even more impartial. Because if you watch the 10 o'clock news with Hugh Edwards and the England football team is playing France, then clearly they can presume the audience is going to want England to win. But you can't have any bias whatsoever because you're truly international. You can't take any sides.
No. So I think sport is always one of those ones, actually, where you just want the best team to win, and you just want, and actually it is one of those ones, it's the beautiful sport, it's the joy of the game, and actually we're just trying to tell that. So if you pick something like the World Cup, that's a really important moment for us as well in our coverage, but that's more about, you suddenly get 32 nations all come together and you've got that chance to kind of, actually Argentina is playing France, or you suddenly end up, there's loads to unpack there, or, well, there's fascinating stories.
Let me ask the question in a better way then, which is Brexit, for example, the lens through which all, we're here in the UK. Mm-hmm. So the BBC News, the 6 and the 10 and all of our national media are framing it as Britain trying to get the best deal for itself, and not unreasonably. But you can't do that.
No. So that's not my, that's not my job. My job is to look at Brexit as one of the many issues facing
geopolitics.
Yes. And, is to explain Brexit in terms of the UK, but also to explain it as part of the UK versus the EU 27, and then also to look at the other issues and not get so sucked into, as one of the, there was a I think the economics editor for the Irish Times or something was writing a piece about everything can't be seen through the Brexit goggles. And actually, that's really my job is to make certain that you don't forget about all the issues facing the EU. So, for example, at the EU summit, we had our teams there and we work with news gathering teams in Brussels. But my job was to report as much about the EU defence and the EU financial issues that were coming out of that as it was about Brexit, because Brexit was one tiny part of what 28 EU members were discussing. Actually, it's one of those ones that we always need to remind ourselves to just think about the audiences that actually you're being watched. You know, we are actually broadcasting to an audience in France or Germany or in North America. We have to even begin to explain the thing from, because beyond Brexit, they kind of, there was a vote, there was a referendum, they're done. Why are we still talking about it 1 year on, let alone 2 years down the road? But it is also, but actually we're really fortunate because we have about, you know, on you know, we've at least got 7 or 8 or 9 different European nationalities work on World News. So actually, you've got lots of voices clamouring, whether it's sort of me with an Irish hat on or my friends, you know, our planning editor who's German, or we've got the sort of French, Romanian, Polish, you know, we have a whole
like
mix
a
of people,
UN.
You know, exactly, with Polish and Dutch as well. So actually, people all see it in different ways. And actually, kind of those voices are always very loud as well, and helping to ensure that other people, you know, that we don't get sucked into a UK prism of it.
Has it made you more internationalist in your outlook in terms of the way that you take your own news? We mentioned just before the podcast started that sometimes you don't pay attention to UK news as much, if I might say that. Is that because you're professionally and personally now, your eyes are on what's happening around the world?
Yes. I mean, I think that's always been my interest. I mean, I was whether it was from just my interest in history growing up and then doing kind of politics and economics and looking particularly at kind of communist politics, then ending up out in Russia, working across Europe, working for an international company in CNN in those days, you weren't allowed to use the word foreign. It was a particular Ted Turner thing that the word foreign was banned. And so you're writing the television script and you would realise that the word foreigners or foreign, and you would have to kind of do mental arithmetic to find another.
Though, isn't
yes.
It? Like someone's enclave is another person's exclave.
Yeah. So it was, and so that just sort of formed me, and they were the things that fascinated me. And whether it was things like the breakup of the former Soviet Union, and then you knew that what was going on in Central Asia was impacted by India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, whether it was then sort of covering the Balkan Wars and realizing how many different players were involved. And my husband's American, so we have a mixed bag of sort of personal backgrounds amongst us at home as a family, and then just having lived abroad. And I just, it's not as much as well about being an internationalist, but I just like to see things from different perspectives. And so it's not a question of being right or wrong, or, and yes, of course, it's being objective and unbiased, but actually it's even more about ensuring that we reflect different viewpoints, because there is no single correct viewpoint. And if you viewed everything from a sort of northern hemisphere perspective of a kind of Downing Street, Whitehall, foggy bottom, Washington DC, White House perspective, then you end up in a very narrow perspective. But you then to kind of, so the challenge is to look at things from down under and to see things in a different way.
Did you always want to be a journalist?
Oh, no. That was never on the cards. I mean, it would never have occurred to me in Ireland growing up to move into journalism. I was going to be a lawyer. And the issue was whether I was going to do commercial law or constitutional law was my... And then my father saw postgraduate and we were sitting in the back garden. And he said, oh, look, there's a Russian language and international commerce diploma course that's just opened up. And isn't that interesting? And it just appealed to me. And he said, well, absolutely, just go take the year and do that, and you can come back to your, you know, law qualifications in a year's time.
And you're still here after all these years.
And I never came back.
Did you speak any Russian at that point?
No, I mean, a few words. I'd gone there.
So you spoke as much Russian as I do at that point.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So I had gone there the summer before for a couple of weeks on a college trip, and I'd was studying communist politics and doing my sort of finals as the Berlin Wall was falling, and feeling that really the academic sort of literature or the academic course was bearing no relevance to actually what was happening
it was a
in
latency,
reality.
As we would say in PR.
So it wasn't, but I just had a sort of a love and an interest in it, probably as lots of students do, again, in that slightly utopian idea about, you know, the world would be fair and equal. And
oh, no, we don't want any of that.
Yeah. And so then I ended up going out. So I did a 6-month intensive language course and then went out.
In Russian.
And then went out on a six. It was an exchange program. And then I did 6 months. I was doing then went out to do a 6-month work placement with a Russian bank. In turn, the Trade Management Institute in Dublin took Russian bankers who were trying to learn international commerce. And so that was a kind of, it was a quid pro quo sort of barter arrangement, as barter arrangements were very common in those days.
How fluent were you after 6 months?
Because the focus was on speaking it, I was, no, I mean, after 6 months, it was once I got there that the sort of fluency developed. But it was also in a rather strange way. But because it was Russian language and international commerce, I arrived out there knowing words for banking and joint venture and business and management, and realised I went to the market and I had
you
no idea.
An avocado.
I didn't know what a saucepan was, or I didn't know what a bag was, or I realised that my sort of vocabulary for, you know, food was limited. So I can't ever, and at the end of it, I mean, I was never going to sort of sit down and read Dostoevsky confidently in Russian. But actually, the focus was all on sort of verbal and communications. And the Russians were great, you know. They would always sort of say to you, you're so fluent, so your confidence would build all the time. Unlike when you sort of go to France and you would feel, oh, gosh, I made a grammatical error there. That will be frowned on. And the Russians would just say, you're amazing, you're fluent, you're brilliant. So, you know, it was a great place to work.
I don't think anyone really cares in modern parlance whether someone makes a grammatical error. And if you do, then you're obviously someone not worth chatting to. So during that process, had a light bulb gone off where you then wanted to commit to journalism?
So the work placement for the Russian bank there wasn't much work involved. I was earning rubles, and so as a student, I was looking to kind of earn hard currency to supplement my income. Because myself and my friend, we were fairly clear that we wanted to go out and not be a drain on our parents, and we were going to live on the ruble salary we got. And so I did things like babysitting and a few other odd things like that to earn hard currency. But I was babysitting at one point for a family who worked for ABC News. So that was sort of my. I then realized, oh, okay. There's a media companies, and then there was the Bush-Gorbachev summit in the summer of 1990, and we just asked, they needed runners. They need just young students to just run tape, do whatever else was happening, because it was a big summit and the NBC were pool. So I worked for them for a week. And then the coup happened in August, and I opened the phone book and I thought, well, everybody will be busy with NBC, so we just went down the list, and CNN was next on the list. And
so, did you kind of cold call them?
I cold called them on the and said, "Do you need any help? Do you need anybody to come in and work for you?" And they said, "Yes."
This is the stuff of legend, isn't it?
I mean, I was 21. I was rather naive in some ways, but I called them up, and I remember the producer at the time said, "Yes, and you may need to run tape from our office down to the White House, and there are tanks there, and if you want to wear a flak jacket, you can wear one." And I went, "Okay." I didn't end up running tape. I spent most of the time working from sort of 2 p.m. to midnight, you know, monitoring the wires and logging the news and running tape, you know, running stuff up and down to the bureau teams on the roof, and then eventually got out, you know, got out of the building over the next couple of months and kept working there.
Was CNN a good first start for you in journalism?
It was a brilliant first start, but it was also because it had been a very small bureau, and then the coup happened, and the country started to open up. The bureau expanded because it was so, the news demand was so huge. The restrictions were fewer. So actually the bureau grew, and we traveled all over the place. I covered all of, traveled across Russia, across the former Soviet Union. And I learned on the job as I went, and I had some great mentors, and it was absolutely fascinating. And you realize, but I, at the end of my period there, and I remember when I sort of came to London, I realized there were huge swathes of the world that I just didn't have that knowledge or background of, like things like the Middle East, I had no experience of. And so, you know, well, that's what I've always loved, is kind of learning about other places and sort of understanding the background, mostly as well because I love history and history helps to inform things.
Do you think that the Russian people at the moment, in the culture of Trump and all of these leaks and inquiries and everything, that they're being unfairly maligned? Because, you know, in the 90s and even the last decade, things seem to thaw out a bit. We seem to be officially friends with Russia, whereas now we have this awkward relationship. mainly because of the two presidents?
I think it's more complex than that. I think, and many people sort of far more erudite than I am have written really well about this and about, you know, were there lost moments in the 1990s when capitalism came in and sort of people were on their knees with sort of you end up with the robber barons on one end and then sort of terrible poverty on the other, whether there was a lack of understanding on both sides, which then just exacerbated over the years. So do I think people don't understand? I mean, I think the Trump thing is less relevant, but I think over the years, do people not understand what makes Russia tick? Absolutely. There are those who have understood and have tried to explain it, but equally, there it's not all, you know, the choices made by Russia, for example, are not necessarily always right. So again, that's kind of what I mean. While not giving you a cop-out answer, I think it's really important you see things from more than one perspective. Innately, and we've got quite a few Russian speakers who work for us, and because I have this sort of, having seen it through the 90s, the changes that happened there, and that you cannot just say, well, Russia isn't doing this, or Russia isn't following this attitude, or they should be more democratic, or they should be doing X, Y, or Z. So I think it's about trying to understand how we've got to this place.
The current settlement seems to be that although we're not enemies and not likely to become enemies, we seem to be determined to not be friends anymore.
Well, when we say we, what do we mean by what do you mean by we? Do you mean are you
countries
speaking
other than I was a self-appointed representative of the rest of the world.
So if you pick places like India, they're very friendly with Russia. I think the key thing is there's a distinction between Russia and President Putin, and I think that's also important to understand. So when we can sort of talk about Russia in general terms and then therefore be using Russia instead of actually Putin or the Russian administration. And again, it's about, you know, sometimes it's about saving face, sometimes it's about seeing it from a different perspective. And again, the years of, you know, what went on in the 90s will have, you know, has formed and shaped and influenced so many people who today are in charge, you know, 20 odd years on. And actually, you know, when you think about how they watch that kind of, you know, the country just go to its knees in poverty in many ways, and I think that can shape it. It's also a huge, huge country. It's a massive country. It's a massive, complex country. And we can often also end up just looking at it from the perspective of Moscow and forget, actually, if you're sitting over in Asia, the part of Russia that you're looking at is Vladivostok, is everything that's sort of east of the Urals.
What's the challenge with BBC World News in parts of the world where the government are trying to control the state media?
So I think that is very challenging for us, and it's a challenge for the BBC as a whole. So if you pick a country like Thailand, which is very complex, has its laws of lèse majesté, there are quite a lot of restrictions put on.
You can't criticise the monarchy.
You can't criticise the monarchy. So that's very difficult for our team there in Bangkok while trying to report it, but not cross the line that puts their own lives or the lives of their family or local staff in danger. I suppose one can often say is sort of the measure of success sometimes, whether it's China, Malaysia, Thailand, can often be when you realise that somebody reports back and says, oh yes, they're blacking you out every time Jonathan Head's name comes up and they run the report from Jonathan Head, or every time Hong Kong or Tiananmen Square gets mentioned or Falun Gong or whatever it is. And then so I think the challenge is to keep doing it.
Presumably you don't mind being blacked out as opposed to being arrested and incarcerated for the rest of your life.
No. Being blacked out is, we'd obviously rather they weren't blacked out.
No.
We'd rather that it was available, whatever reports we're running are available to see.
But it's honourable journalism, isn't
it?
For you to state it as you see it and then for someone else to decide to censor it, that's their game.
Yeah.
Let's go back to your career then. So how long were you with CNN for, and then what came next?
So I was with CNN from 91 to the end of 97, basically, from when the coup started in 91. Then I moved over to London, mostly because my husband, well my then boyfriend, but I'd done 6 years at that time. And while I loved it, I felt that it was time. It was that point where I didn't want to get fed up with doing stories, or when a new correspondent would come in and they'd say, we should do a piece about moving Lenin's tomb, or we should do a piece about Coke or McDonald's, or this thing. I've done that story so many times, I really can't go back again to Lenin's hometown of Ulyanovsk and all those things. So actually, I sort of think if you're not being enthusiastic and positive in your job, then, you know, that's time
to
move on. And so at the time, I was with my now husband, who works for CNN, and he was looking at the opportunities to move, and one of the options was South Africa, the other was London, and we ended up in London. I said, well, listen, if you move to London, I could try and freelance in London if, you know, if I can't get a job. And so that sort of brought us to London. And then I worked with CNN here in London for about 6 or 9 months, sort of until towards the end of 97, and did things. I did the Tony Blair election. So that was my first sort of experience of UK politics. And
best election ever, that one.
It was a very good, exciting election. And I got my driver's license right in the middle of it as well, I remember.
That would be more stressful than the election result, as far as I'm concerned. So what came after that?
So then I moved to BBC and did that thing that so many people do, where you sort of you've no idea who to approach in the BBC, what this big organisation is,
within the BBC,
what all the different titles are. If somebody's title was, you know, world news, did that mean they were news gathering? Were they not news gathering, or were they? What was they? All of those things were utterly confusing, and I remember sort of sending off lots of emails to letters in those days to lots of different people in the BBC, having no idea how they all fit together. And then I ended up starting to work with them on the with World News Gathering on what's called the intake desk, or the sort of assignments desk. And
so you would be one of the horseshoes in the.
I was one of the horseshoes. Yeah. Exactly. And in true BBC style, started on a 3-month rolling contract that.
Excellent.
Rolled and rolled and rolled and rolled. And it was fascinating. But in those days, the BBC was slowly trying to integrate their international news gathering operation, because prior to that, World Service news gathering was separate. Radio news gathering was separate, TV news gathering was separate, and World TV news gathering was like the tiny little bit that really didn't have any news gathering and was the absolute poor relation. So the years when I was with CNN in Moscow, I'd watch the BBC people and you'd realise they were in four different offices at the time, even if you include monitoring, in different buildings across the city that really didn't have any relationship with each other. And so when I kind of joined the BBC in 98, that was part of that big effort to bring news gathering together, to bring them into the same bureaus, to make people in what those days was bimedial. And then before you know it, then the digital stuff came along and suddenly everybody was trimedial.
In hindsight, years later, though, it seems obvious, isn't it, that these changes needed to be made?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was, I remember at one point being on the intake, what's called the intake. So, you know, I was the sort of world news gathering duty editor for World TV one time. And this was very much in the beginning. And really, you know, trying to sort of, I was sort of transposing my experience of CNN and assuming that the way that the CNN international desk would work, and if I was in a bureau, would be the same way the BBC would work, and then realised actually it wasn't. And I remember picking up the phone and calling a correspondent in a bureau and then being sort of given out to by somebody who was looking after domestic TV and said, no, you know, that's not your correspondent to speak to. You should only be speaking to the World Service correspondent. You know, you don't. The domestic TV correspondent doesn't work for you. And you were thinking, it's just the BBC, and if they're not doing anything, why wouldn't they do that? So I think that was and it was a very large cultural change at that time. And I mean, it at the same time, they were moving from one computer system to another, and
sounds like a
building
nightmare.
You know, offices were areas where they were working in the old television center, the one studio was being moved and another one taking its place. And shortly after that, news channel launched as well. So it was all part of a whole sort of structural change, which never stopped since then.
It seems to be ongoing change, doesn't it? Yeah. But was there a bit of a cultural change in terms of when you joined the BBC? Did you have to quickly learn the BBC way of doing things? Because as you've just said, it was also changing as you were there as well.
So I think, yes, it was a massive cultural shock. And, you know, there's little things about you suddenly realise that in TV, what you might call a font in CNN is called an Aston in BBC, and then you'd realise it would be called a soup or somewhere else. People use different language, so there would be little things like that, and there were things about understanding why they did stuff. And I remember always, sort of years later, would say for the first couple of years, I'd question things all the time. Why do we do that? That doesn't make sense. And then you realise you stop questioning things and
Absolutely.
You take it as norm. And it was one of those things I always remember saying to people when they would be new and start to arrive. I sort of said, just shout out and say the things that you think don't make sense, or why do we do things the way they do, because there's generally no good reason why we do it that way.
I find my own business when people start, you know, why do you do this? I was thinking,
there was a cultural difference, there was a sort of organisational structural difference, and then there's also sort of, it was British and not American. But its fundamental premise from where I came from on the international side was to tell the stories of what's going on internationally. but it just had that richness as well of the sort of radio heritage that came with it, the multiple language services and everything. So that was also sort of part of the difference.
The licence fee is always continuously under pressure. Has that affected the resources that you've got at your disposal?
Yes, because it affects the international news gathering bureaus. So whereas before there might have been two correspondents in a bureau, now there's one correspondent. So actually that affects the ability to be able to, if there's breaking news, then obviously the priority is for the person to go out and report, you know, or it might be to sort of send in material to go out and do a package for radio package or a TV package rather than actually be able to stand on location and do lives. And so there's a trade-off on those things. But definitely the licence fee cuts, you know, do impact. But it also actually, on the other way as well, it impacts on some of it that the support services are fewer, whether it's in finance, HR and all those things that...
But has technology helped with that? Because I know a few correspondents myself that just use Lucy Live from their own iPhone. As long as they've got 4G, they can go live.
Yes.
I've not seen it on BBC News much, but people have been doing lives through their iPhone
or through Skype. We do quite a bit on that. But because there's been the advent of that, but it doesn't mean that any other output has dropped away. I think that's always the challenge with the BBC, is actually in the very nature of news, that it, because it continues to diversify and there's more and more ways that people want to consume news, therefore the demand to do tailored output for whether it's your Facebook Live versus your TV Live versus your Radio 4 1800 Bulletin or the World Service News Hour or the 10 o'clock news or Newsnight or Breakfast News, the sort of 24-hour a day, 7 days a week across TV, radio and digital platforms is quite,
it's a lot of content.
So it's always great when there's a really big story and only the international output cares about it and you don't have anybody on the domestic side because they're all busy looking at other things and you just think, that's fine, we don't have to manage that. And then the issues come when you actually have slightly divergent editorial agendas, and that's where Europe is challenging, because actually it is absolutely right that the sort of teams in Brussels are making certain they explain Brexit for a UK audience, and that sometimes is not necessarily the same as what I need from the teams in Brussels.
So how does that work then? If you've got someone like Katia Adler, does she repurpose the report for the two different audiences?
So sometimes things are repurposed and sometimes they just can't be repurposed. So as much about if you may end up, and it's language. And again, language is really key. So if you're going to talk about everything in terms of we, then you don't, it's not right for World News to be running a package that says
we.
There's no we. But yet it is absolutely right for a viewer here in the UK for you to try to explain what's happening in a language that is the most appropriate for that listener or viewer here in the UK.
Was the BBC quite blokey when you joined it as an editor? Did you feel... I mean, I don't know what the gender ratio and balance is at the moment.
The answer to that question, though, is also when I joined it, so if that brought me to when I was 29, you know, my perspective was different than my perspective is now, close on, because I'll be 20 years next year with the BBC, which is shocks me every time I think about that.
People who would have got life would already be out by now.
Yeah, and I never imagined I would stay with an organisation for that long. But then again, it's a constantly changing organisation.
And a fantastic one. I'm a huge fan of the BBC.
Yeah. So I think my perspective as a 48-year-old woman is entirely different than my perspective was as a 28-year-old woman, because actually, like anything else, when you come in and you know, I don't need, you've probably seen endless charts, or you can look at all those things about gender bias and unconscious bias, and actually it's as the pyramid gets narrower and narrower that suddenly you don't find yourself at the 50-50 equivalence.
But also your agency increases, your personal agency, because you are a senior BBC person and therefore can do something about it.
So I think the challenge is also about agenda. So I think often you might find it's the choice of stories that you can feel that the gender bias is there about, well, why would you do that story? That's not really important. Or actually the propensity to be obsessed about or to do so much politics that you forget about the voter and the sort of Joe public, if you like. So I think, and I do, yeah, definitely gender is an issue, and it's an issue in so many companies, and it is an issue And it is still there. You can often sit in some of the morning editorial meetings and you have about a sort of a third female and sort of two thirds male. And some of it obviously is impacted because you make choices about what you do as you, you know, whether you then have a family or you change what you do or you need to not work those hours. So I think it struggles with it like many organisations, although, and I think sometimes it's hard to quantify exactly why. And I have two teenage boys. Well, and my 15-year-old told me that gender bias isn't a problem anymore, and pay equality between men and women isn't a problem anymore.
Oh, great. Let's go home and have a drink.
So I sort of said to them, "You're 15 years of age. It all looks a lot more simple. It gets a lot more complex." Is my perspective, and the way I look at things is, I think things are a lot more complex as you get older, and that confidence you think. When I was in school or at college and you think, of course, I can do anything I want. I can go anywhere I want. I can get any job. There is no gender barrier to anything. And then you realise as you, you know, get older, it isn't always quite that black and white.
It's very difficult, though, isn't it, when you're someone like me who's kind of white, male, middle class, you know, early 40s, because we are the privileged group. I remember once that people used to talk about racism on YouTube and I'd never even read it, but when I actually saw it, I realised it was a thing. And even though people had mentioned it before, until I actually saw it with my own eyes, it was almost in my own mind as if it didn't exist.
I think as well, but I also think in answer to your question, I have colleagues who are white, male, and possibly middle-aged, who actually also feel threatened, who also feel actually that they are going to be disadvantaged because suddenly it's going to be harder for them to get on an advancement because actually they don't tick a gender or a diversity box. And so I think people see it in different ways.
It's awful.
Somebody's accused me. I've been told that I've been biased against working mothers. I've been told I'm biased against white middle-aged men. I'm told I'm biased against all sorts of people. So I figure as long as I'm biased against everybody, then I must be hopefully getting the recruitment vaguely right.
Do you ever have an urge to get out on the road and report again?
So I don't. When I stopped going out on the road, it was high withdrawal symptoms. I missed it incredibly. There was a certain point once I got past that, and while I still might go on the odd trip, I think actually I felt that I'd had such a brilliant, you know, 8 years and been so privileged that actually I wanted that opportunity for other people. And if I could get other people, you know, so very much there was a point when I became sort of planning editor for BBC World News back in 2005. And I think at that point I was just basically, if I could get other people out on the road and to get the experiences that I had, I was really happy with that. And at that point I got past the bug because, you know, life got more complicated. My husband kept travelling all the time. At that point, we had children. I just felt we couldn't have two people travel.
Well, you could put the kids in an orphanage and divorce, but that wouldn't, you know, that might not even help your career either. Yeah. At the end of the day, you'd still be on your own.
I think it was one time I was, it was years later, and I remember being in Singapore, and you know, it's going to be 2 o'clock in the morning, and I woke up and the phone's ringing, and it's Ocado saying, "Your order, I'm outside your door, knocking on your door, and sort of, where are you?" And I'm thinking, I'm fast asleep. I have no idea where somebody's supposed to be home to answer the door for the Ocado order. And I was thinking, I can't help you.
What's the best story you've worked on? What's been the most interesting one that's engaged you? Do you like long stories that are going to take months to come to fruition? Or do you like the impactful thing? A helicopter's crashed. You know, there's images of it. One person survived. One person's, died. And then it's done and dusted. Or do you like the ongoing ones?
So I'm not somebody who wants to do the sort of 2-year investigation. That hasn't been really long form investigations hasn't been, you know, an area that I've gone into. I like the immediacy of news. I like immediately explaining it. I like immediately understanding it and trying to work out what this means, why it happened, what it means, what will happen next. I think your helicopter answer, of course, I'd rather if we didn't have news about death and destruction, you know, and like even last weekend, you suddenly went, you know, the oil tanker in Pakistan, and there was a Columbia boat disaster, and you suddenly thought, just one of those ones, and you look and you think, gosh, we've just probably got 300, 400, 500 people around the world have just died, and actually none of those were terrorism-related incidences. They were, you know, just sort of human tragedy, and so I would much rather not deal with those ones.
Do you try to switch off, and as a journalist, as you're covering it, as an editor? Because we had Maxima Winnie in that chair a few weeks ago, and she said that she's just recently stood down from news presenting, yeah. And she actually is experiencing the news differently as a viewer, because if death and destruction happens and she's in the chair, she doesn't think about it emotionally. She's there to get the facts out and report the news, yeah. And it's only afterwards that she then starts to be upset and grieve for the loss of human life.
Because you don't have time to deal with it or process it, or the luxury of processing it when you're there. And it's often, sometimes, it, you know, there are times I can remember sort of driving home and hearing Lise Doucette when she was in Syria, and it was her Radio 4 1800 piece, actually listening to that in the car and realising the sort of tears were streaming down my face, even though the TV report had been going all day. But it was that moment where I wasn't actually...
You felt it as a person.
Yes, I felt it as a person. And I think... So I do think that is it's often, it's when I get home, or sometimes often consuming it in a medium that is different from the medium that I've been working in all day. There are sort of so many highlights and there are lowlights. But, you know, there's been great things I've done, whether it's doing a trip where you've sort of sat as close as you and I are sitting to a Siberian tiger out in the far east of Russia.
Rather you than me. Unless there was a cage between us, I'll come as close as you
he
like.
He was sedated, so that was on the ground sense. So, you know, you can have those amazing things. It's seeing the kind of the visuals of the world. It's being really proud of, and sometimes it can just be a day where you're really proud of actually the number of stories we did and how well we covered something, you know, that we've done the best we can in trying to make sense of the world at any given minute or hour. I think it's often, people often talk about 9/11 as being one of those seismic moments. I was on maternity leave. I had a 2-month-old baby. It happened. My husband went off to Afghanistan. I went home to my parents and...
You watched the news.
I didn't. I literally just got told, my husband came home. He sort of, one plane went in, the second plane went in. He called me, said there's a driver coming out to collect my passport. And I just said, you've just woken him up. It took me 2 hours to get this small crying baby to sleep. And I was just, and then I just, I left. And I thought when I came back after that in January, I thought the world would have changed completely. I thought everything would be different. I thought I wouldn't know how to fit into this work, into work again. I thought I got left behind. And then 24 hours later, it was like, news is news.
So last question then. Let's say a young person comes to you and says that they want to be the next you 20, 30 years from now, whenever it is that they want to get your job, and they're starting out on their career. One, would you advise them to do it? And two, what would your advice be to them?
So that was funny. So when my son was going for an interview in school, for secondary school at one point, and he said, he came out afterwards and he said, yeah, that was fine. I said, what did they ask you? And they said, where do you see yourself in 10 years' time or something like that? They asked him, or what do you think you're going to be doing when you're 25? And he turned around and he said, well, I'd like to be a journalist, like my mum with BBC and my dad with CNN. And I said, great answer, don't do it. But the reality is, I think it's an absolute privilege to do it. I think it is much harder. I was really lucky. I had a good break. I was in the right place at the right time. I think it is a very, very challenging career because it's so fractured. There are so many different options and the competition is so tough. I think you need to know going into it that it's a tough career. I think it's not like other jobs where you sort of can sit there and you can go to work in the morning and you can read your novel on the way in or something. You can't. You need to have done an hour's work before you get to work. You need to have figured out what's going on in the news. You need to have read stuff. You need to have worked it out. You can't switch off. You know, yes, you're on shifts. Maybe you've got some downtime, but equally, you've got to, if you've got 3 days off and you've done 4 on, 3 off, the last day, you might be able to switch off the first day afterwards, but you can't switch off the last day before you come back into work. So I think you need to be really clear about what you want to do about it. You know, what part of news you want to work in, what drives you. I would also say, I think the variety of experience that you have before you enter news is a good thing. And whether that's because you might have done a humanities degree or you might have done different things, but that only having a journalism experience may not be the best thing, and that you might find that you've got different options. And whether that's you've gone and lived abroad or you've gone and done different things. So I think that would be my advice to people. But I think it's hard. I think if you want to kind of get into news, what bit do you want to get into? Where do you want to get into it? How do you want to get into it? And the competition is really tough.
Anna, we've run out of metaphorical tape. Thank you ever so much for your time. I hugely enjoyed that.
I do enjoy it as well. Thank you very much for having me.
A Right Angles podcast in association with Big Things Media.